Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, a classic speech by Michael Parenti from 1999. It explained U.S. foreign policy then, and it explains U.S. foreign policy today. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we go back to the 90s again. Last week, we heard comedian Bill Hicks. This week, political scientist Michael Parenti. Hicks is gone, but Parenti is still alive and kicking at age 80, and still worth hearing. I first encountered Parenti years ago on non-commercial alternative radio. He offered a language that made American foreign policy make sense, particularly our constant military interventions everywhere. The government's official story of why we were intervening seldom made much sense, so this country's actions just seemed insane, self-defeating. But Parenti showed the sense it all made. Public policies were not insane, ineffective, and self-defeating. They were perfectly sane, rational, and often effective. It's just that their real goals were not the goals that the president announced to the public. We'll hear a talk Parenti gave in 1999. It made good sense of American policy then, and I think you'll find it makes good sense of American policy now also. The talk is titled, Globalization, the New Imperialism. We'll hear half of it today and the rest next week. I hope it strikes you the way it strikes me. Intellectually brilliant, witty, sometimes very funny, and very, very clarifying. Here's what I would call the key idea from this talk. Governments do not turn their countries into empires for the sake of greater national glory. Governments turn their countries into empires in order to enrich powerful private economic interests. American imperialism has a purpose. That purpose is to increase the profits of the Fortune 500. End of story. Just a reminder that when Parenti says George Bush, he means George Bush I, and Gulf War means Gulf War I. Back then, we had had only one of each. The talk is called Globalization, the New Imperialism, but we'll start out with the old traditional imperialism. Different style, same goals. Here is Michael Parenti.
I thought I'd begin by talking about all of humanity. You know, start with a small subject and then build up like that. All of humanity can be divided into three groups. Group A is made up of those people who live off their stock dividends, the interest on their bonds, their land and mineral and oil royalties, and the rents they collect. They make up less than 1% of the world's population. They live primarily off that. I mean, David Rockefeller may also get a salary at Rockefeller Brothers Association, I don't know, but that isn't how he gets rich. He gets rich from all this coming in. Group B and C are the other 99-point-something% of humanity. The people in Group B live off wages, salaries, fees, commissions, pensions. And Group C is made up of about 1 billion people of the world's population, and they live in utter desperation. They don't have wages, salaries, pensions. They live from hand to mouth. They live on scraps, and they live in hunger and utter desperate poverty. Now, what the people in Group A and B have in common is that they both live off the labor of the people in Group B and Group C, of course. And we hear a great deal about rich nations and poor nations, but we should keep in mind that groups A, B, and C are found in all nations. You have people of A, B, and C right here in the U.S. You have them in Zaire, and you have them in Indonesia, etc. And we often refer to the juxtaposition of wealth and poverty. We often make reference to the juxtaposition. We say, ah, there's such a great wealth here and such great poverty here. Isn't that terrible, this contrast, this gap? And what can we now do about the poverty? And then we sort of forget about the wealth. What can we do about these people? How can we help them? And what we really ought to start doing is recognizing that there's a dialectical interaction, interrelationship between these two things, that there's no accident that there's great wealth and great poverty, that great wealth creates great poverty, that wealth creates poverty. Throughout history, societies that had no great concentrations of wealth generally had no great poverty. There could be scarcities, there could be modest levels of consumption, but not the extremes we have today. There could be hunger if the crops failed, if the herds disappeared, but that hunger was shared by everybody. And there was always a place at the fireplace for everyone. Wealth, ladies and gentlemen, causes poverty. Now that's not what the ideology of capitalism tells us. The slogans are quite different. The slogans are designed to create a false community of interest. We hear that a rising tide lifts all boats. It's class partnership, not class war. It's not zero sum. As the pie gets bigger, we all get a bigger slice of it. Well, in fact, a rising tide can sink many boats. Most of the gains that we have won have not come from a larger pie, but through democratic struggle. It is zero sum, and that is what the people in Group A are keenly aware of. You see, every dollar I have to pay to you for some stupid, annoying, unnecessary thing like wages, occupational safety, pension funds, health plans, environmental protections. Every dollar I have to pay out for those stupid things is one less dollar that goes into my pocket. And I am keenly aware of that. And if you think there's any boss, any owner, who isn't always directed by that consideration in everything he does, then you should learn something about who are the people who own and control the wealth of our society, who sit on the boards of directors of the corporations, the banks, the hospital corporations, the museums, the media cartels, and the like. Wealth causes poverty, and poverty creates wealth in that dynamic. You can't have rich plantation owners unless you have slaves who are working from dawn to dusk and even after dusk, working hard to create that wealth, consuming but a small portion of it for their own meager, miserable subsistence, so that the rest could go off to the people in the great house on the hill who live in a style of utter luxury and whatever. You can't have rich feudal lords in the manors unless you have serfs who are doing the same thing. And you can't have rich corporate conglomerates unless you have wage and salary workers who will work a whole lifetime and at the end of that lifetime not know any kind of economic security of any sort, own nothing but maybe a mortgage on their house or whatever, if that. So the secret to getting rich, ladies and gentlemen, is not to work hard but to get others to work hard for you. I've had that in one of my books, and I got a letter from a student out somewhere, I forget where, I think in Midwest somewhere, who said, dear Professor Parenti, we are using your book, and on page 28 or something, you say, the secret to getting rich is not to work hard, but to have others work hard for you. And then he said, I think that's very good advice. Could you tell me what would be the places where I could go where I could get people to work hard for me at very low wages so that I could get as rich as possible as soon as possible? Snicker, snicker, you know. Wise guy. So I took his letter. It was signed Theodore something the third, right? So I wrote all across the top. I said, dear Teddy, some jackass sent me this letter and signed your name to it. And I mailed it back to him. And I don't think that was the answer he was expecting. But as wealth concentrates, poverty spreads. The number of people living in poverty today throughout the world is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. And wealth is concentrating in vaster, vaster conglomerates. Now, why is that happening? Why do people in some countries work for 18 cents an hour? Would you work for 18 cents an hour? No, you wouldn't. Now, why is that? Is it because you're so much more resourceful, so much smarter than the Indonesians? Is it because you have higher self-esteem than the Zairians? Why is it you wouldn't work for 18 cents an hour? Well, it's because of the level of democratic struggle where we happen to be at. If conditions got ratcheted down and grounded down, the day might come when we might be working for 18 cents an hour. The Indonesians worked that way because of the relative conditions of labor and capital, because of the relative conditions of democracy versus plutocracy, because of the relative conditions of poverty and wealth. And so what you have is this struggle. The Indonesians and the Zairians and the people in Asia and Africa and Latin America are also the victims of what I call maldevelopment in my book Against Empire. The poverty of the third world is not an original historical condition. It's not a neutral, natural historical process. They're not that poor because they just live in those warm climates and they're lazy. That's what I learned when I was a kid in school, that people in tropical climates just can't get it together. They have too many kids. They like to dance too much and they just don't concentrate and aren't hardworking, and so that's why they're so poor. You know, they're stupid people, not like us. That's not true. I'm glad you're laughing. It's true. Okay, Walter Rodney, who was later assassinated, a Caribbean, wrote an interesting book entitled, a very interesting title, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. What's interesting about that is the use of the word underdeveloped as a verb. How Europe underdeveloped Africa. Rodney was pointing out that Africa, you know, had a level of production, consumption, civilization, that the people in Africa were quite capable of building this remarkable country that they had. Countries, I should say, sorry. In fact, when Cecil Rhodes and his cutthroats went into the ancient kingdom of Zimbabwe, which he then modestly renamed Rhodesia after himself, now renamed Zimbabwe, but at that time, they came upon architectural artifacts which they couldn't figure out how they were built. There wasn't any plaster, there wasn't any nails, and you couldn't get a slip of paper between the massive stones. How did they calculate? How did they do these things? They had no idea. They were too busy, of course, killing the native denizens of these lands and taking over their lands. And that's what happens to these people. Their lands are taken from them. Their lands are taken over and given over to commercial cash export crops, to mining and minerals. The goal of capitalism is to transfer living nature into commodities and commodities into capital. That's the constant goal, is to take nature. Nature is one of the natural resources which you then use, which is one of the sources. There are just two sources of wealth. That's nature, the land, the minerals, all these things, and the human labor power that you put into it to transform those things, to make them marketable and give them exchange value. So these societies, self-sustaining, self-employing, give way to wage labor. They give way to utter destitution. They give way to shanty towns, to disease, to underemployment. And that process went on in Africa and India. That's a process that began even in England in the late 18th century with the English peasantry of deracination, driving people off the land, de-skilling, and turning them into subsistence labor. Take the case of India. In India, in 1800, India was exporting more textiles to world markets than England was. Between 1800 and 1830, the Brits went in with their gunboats and they de-industrialized the great textile centers of Dhaka and Madras and drove those people back out onto the land to go raise the raw materials, the cotton, and put up prohibitive tariff barriers against Indian goods in England and such. And that whole relationship transferred, and the Indian textile market was destroyed. By the way, the Indian terms are still used in textile. Madras is a pattern, right? Paisley, those are Indian things. India's debt from 1850 to 1900 grew by 53 million pounds. The per capita income in India in that time declined by 65%, almost two-thirds. So India was being underdeveloped, you see. That's why I don't call them the underdeveloped world or the developing world. Even the developing world, which is a euphemism for underdeveloped, still implies that the original condition was poverty, and now they're these late-blooming developers. They're finally developing and catching up. They were not underdeveloped. They were overexploited. Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's collaborator, who we are all taught is irrelevant and has nothing to say, he took a trip to Ireland in 1856. And Ireland now is the oldest of Britain's imperialisms, 800 years. And they're white people, they're Caucasians, Europeans. I make that point because I want to make clear that the function of imperialism is not racism. Racism is a very good rationale, and it's a very good weapon and a bludgeon to be used. When you starve people out, when you destroy their villages, when you murder their men and rape their women and spit their babies or enslave them to build the mines and all that, you have to justify that, and so you say they're moral inferiors, they're savages, they're animals and all sorts of things. But you didn't go there because they're black. You went there because their land had wealth in it, and you wanted to exploit them and use them. And you'll do that to whites. The first imperialisms were against other Europeans, Ireland and Eastern Europe. And that's how Western Europe began its first capital accumulation and colonizing. And this is what Engels says as late as 1856 now. We've already had, by then, about 400 years of British imperialism in Ireland. Quote, "How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they have been crushed politically and industrially." Get that? Not just politically, which is always what's focused on, but industrially too. Never mentioned. "By consistent oppression," Engels goes on, "they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation." Now the key words there are artificially converted, you see. It's not that they were just naturally poor. They were artificially converted into poverty. "The poorer I can keep you, the hungrier I can keep you, the harder you will work for less." And that's when you line up for a job that's 18 cents an hour. "The Mayan Indians in Guatemala, in the early 16th century, before the Europeans came, had a better diet, more calories, more protein, and better conditions of health than they do today. They had more artists. They had more musicians, more architects, more horticulturalists than they do today. They're not underdeveloped, they're overexploited. They're not underdeveloped, they're maldeveloped. And these conditions are brought about by a process of capital penetration, market domination, superior mobilization of force and violence, and then the expropriation of land and labor. People in these countries don't need to be taught how to farm. They need the land to farm and the implements and the seeds. They don't need to be taught how to fish. They need the boats and the nets and access to shore frontage and bays and oceans and someone to stop the chemical plants and oil tankers from dumping their toxics into the waters. They don't need to be convinced that they should be using hygienic standards. They need the conditions that will allow them to have clean drinking water, clean clothes and homes. They don't need nutritional advice on balanced diets from some Peace Corps volunteer from North America. They need food, and they usually know better than the North Americans what foods serve their nutritional needs. Now, U.S. intervention goes on throughout the world to make that world safe for the people in column A. This is a very hard point for many Americans to accept, that their government is not pursuing all these things all around the world out of a concern for this little people here or that little brown or black or white people, if you talk about Kosovo, yourself there. That's what's really motivating us. We're humanitarian. We're concerned. We're concerned about democracy. We want to bring them elections and all that. People really think that's what's motivating people like George Bush and Bill Clinton. The United States has a global empire. It has about 300 major military bases all over the world. Its troops are stationed on just about every continent. Its planes fly over every region. Its ships sail every sea. Why? We're told we have to protect America. We have to protect it from those who might want to be coming after us and attack us. Never understand why they don't want to attack Denmark, let's say, or Finland or something. Why America? They There are people out there who might want to get us, you know. Or we have to just intervene to help all these other poor people. Well, in fact, the United States, the U.S. leaders have not been interested in propagating democracy. They have supported some of the worst fascist dictators throughout the world, in country after country. And they have, in fact, overthrown any kind of government that has tried to perform any kind of redistributive politics, that is, has tried to in any way cut a somewhat better deal for the people in column B and C as opposed to the people in column A. And when any government or any movement tries to infringe on the overweening privileges of the people in column A, that's when U.S. force comes on them. It happened in Portugal during the Colonel's Rebellion in the 1970s. Whether it be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas, a social democracy coalition in Chile under Allende, which was a popular front of a diverse number of parties, democratically elected, overthrown by the CIA. In Jamaica, another social democratic coalition under Michael Manley, overthrown by the CIA. In Greece, under Papandreou in 1965, democratically elected government. The Dominican Republic under Bosch, democratically elected government. Or it could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea. Or it could be an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya, under Gaddafi. Or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in by the CIA. But he wanted to cut a better deal on oil, you see. Saddam Hussein also put in very unsavory and unnecessary and ridiculous things like free health care and free education in Iraq. Those are the kind of things which indicate that you are suspect, that you are not properly dedicated to free market neoliberalism. And you then will have to be dealt with. And there were people in America, I remember students saying to me, I cannot believe that my country is bombing Iraq and killing all those people simply because of a question of oil. They're doing it because they want to rescue the Kuwaitis. I said, no, they're not. The Iraqi army is leaving Kuwait and they're still killing them. He said, I cannot believe that. I have faith in George Bush, who was president at the time. And that's a scary thing to hear it from a young person. You have faith in George Bush? I trust him. I said, you have faith in George Bush the way my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony? I mean, you light candles to George Bush? You say, oh, Giorgi, Giorgi, Madonna. Is that what you do? What do you mean you have faith? What is this religion we're dealing with here? You trust George Bush? You're not supposed to trust him. I mean, trust is something that you reserve only for very close friends and relatives and loved ones. And even them, check them out once in a while, right? The whole essence of democracy isn't trust. The essence of democracy is distrust, you see. It's accountability. It's answerability. It's exposure. It's challenge. It's debate. It's explaining yourself, please. George Bush, Jesus Christ. He would get up there and he'd say, I'm going to get Saddam Hussein. You know, that dynamic way he talked. Oh, Georgie hit me. Oh, wow. There was a very cruel feminist, a cruel, cruel feminist who once said, George Bush reminds every woman of her first husband. Which I laughed at, you know, And then I started thinking about it, and I called my ex-wife. I said, do I remind you of George Bush? She said, what are you talking about? I felt better. We all have our moments of insecurity, you know. The public record shows that the United States is the foremost interventionist power in the world. One of the reasons for intervening is to protect direct investments or to create opportunities for new investments or to take over what are potential resources that are there. In Somalia, for instance, you had 2/3 of the country was under contract because of oil reserves that had been discovered in Somalia. And that's when Bush sent troops into Somalia. You remember that? And again, we had our Boy Scout liberals, our friends saying, I can't believe he said would send troops in there for anything. He's going there because he said there's a famine and he's going to help them. And you have to say, helping the starving Somalians with marines and tanks and guns, and how does that feed them exactly? I mean, when did George Bush ever indicate in all his entire political career that he cared about starving Africans? There was famine in about 7 countries in Africa. Why did he go into Somalia? What about all the other places where hunger was being... later on, he wrote a book with Brent Scowcroft admitting that the whole war in the Gulf was about oil. He said it was about oil. It's interesting. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson, who was later to become President of the United States, he recognized the support role that the capitalist state plays on behalf of private capital global investments. Quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down." Isn't that interesting imagery? I mean, just come right out and they say it. "Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused." And later, as President of the United States, Wilson noted that the U.S. was, quote, "involved in a struggle to command the economic fortunes of the world." Now, more important than protecting particular holdings of specific corporations is protecting the whole process of investment and profit. And that means preventing any country from developing a competing social order, any country from developing a means whereby they start using some portion of the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets and the capital for things other than private capital accumulation, where they start using it for the people in column B and C, rather than for the interests of the people in column A. The goal is to prevent the emergence of competing social orders and obliterate all workable alternatives to the capitalist client state. That's exactly what the targeting of Yugoslavia was about. Yugoslavia was one of the very few countries that refused to join the World Trade Organization. Yugoslavia had no interest in becoming a part of NATO. Yugoslavia retained some semi-socialist economy. The goal was to divide, dismember Yugoslavia, play ethnic groups against each other, cripple their economy, and then go in as the humanitarian rescuers, even though you've been the greatest instigators of the war itself. There's nothing terribly original about that. Milosevic is demonized as the horrible demon. Gaddafi was demonized as the terrible demon, and then he was bombed, attacked, and sanctions were put on Libya, and the Libyan economy was severely crippled by the sanctions. Noriega was demonized as a swamp rat, a worse than Hitler, so forth, so on. Saddam Hussein was demonized as a Hitler, so forth. Milosevic, who is not a Hitler, who is not even a Saddam Hussein, is now called worse than Hitler. Images of the Holocaust and all sorts of atrocity stories, mass graves that have never materialized, and on and on. And once again, we have people being led into the hubris of bombing and killing and destroying another country out of humanitarian concern. Doing it, though, with humanitarian bombs.
On New World Notes, that was Michael Parenti with the first half of a brilliant talk from 1999, Globalization, the New Imperialism. We will hear the second half next week. Catch the show on the airwaves or catch it on the internet at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum, pump up those bicycle tires, and please come back again next week. Ciao.